You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.
Hi, everyone. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape. This is This Week in Cardiology for September 11th, 2015. This week, I'm going to talk about left atrial appendage isolation in AF ablation, the evaluation of the female athlete in terms of cardiac adaptation, PCSK9 drugs, the controversial issue of a sugar tax, and the importance of nutrition. First up, I want to talk about the BELIEF trial. This was in a hotline session at ESC, Dr. Luigi DiBiase presented results of the randomized controlled trial called BELIEF. This was a study done in patients with longstanding persistent atrial fibrillation who were referred for catheter ablation. The aim was to assess the value of empiric left atrial appendage isolation in addition to standard ablation. Now, let's first set out that standard ablation in the hands of this group is quite extensive. This group does pulmonary vein isolation, and it includes the entire back wall of the left atrium. It includes any non-pulmonary vein triggers. It would be fair to say that standard ablation in their hands is extensive. So the question is, what about left atrial appendage isolation add-on? In the BELIEF trial, 85 patients got the appendage isolation in addition to standard ablation, and 88 patients got the standard ablation alone. Repeat procedures were pretty common, 62 patients in total, 27 in the appendage isolation, and 35 in the standard group had repeat procedures. The results favored the appendage isolation group. AFib-free survival at 12 months with one procedure in the left atrial appendage isolation group was 56% versus only 28% in the standard isolation. Now, at 24 months and considering repeat procedures, that success rate increased to 76% in the appendage isolation group versus 56% in the standard group. Transesophageal echocardiograms were done in all patients who had appendage isolation, and interestingly, half the patients had gained left atrial appendage function and half had not. Strokes were seen, but interestingly, only in the group of standard isolation. Here, four patients, the standard isolation group, had strokes, and no patient in the appendage isolation group had a stroke. That's kind of remarkable because this group of ablationists have been famous for publishing very low stroke rates in ablation. So the BELIEF trial and the fact that it was chosen for a hotline presentation at ESC is quite scary to me. The study discussant, Professor Gerhard Hendricks from Leipzig, he raised many questions about the underpinnings of the trial, the methodology, and results. And I agree with him. I see five big issues here. One is, I'm not sure the left atrial appendage is as big a problem or trigger for AF as this group feels it is. Second, I'm worried about the extensiveness of the ablation. I mean, consider that half the cohort of BELIEF had CHAD scores less than two. So that's half with CHAD scores 0 to 1. Third, if left atrial appendage isolation actually works, by definition, it creates a stasis. That is a non-contractile appendage. And that stasis could be a nidus for future stroke. It certainly means long-term, forever anticoagulation. Fourth, we already have a pretty well-established approach to patients with persistent atrial fib. The STAR-AF True trial showed that PVI alone was more effective than PVI plus other ablation. And also, recently, the ARREST-AF trial and the CardioFit trial shows that risk factor modification, including weight loss and just routine old exercise, helps improve outcomes of in patients with AFib, regardless of whether they get ablation or not, or even if they get ablation. And finally, this is controversial, but I think electrophysiologists have to be mindful of cost. I mean, can we keep doing these procedures that cost tens of thousands of dollars with the kind of success rates and redo procedures that are being required? I don't know. I'm just asking. I've thought a lot about this, and I've expanded on these concerns in my column this week on trials and fibrillation. Next up is the issue of cardiac adaptation, but specifically in the female athlete. Dr. Sanjay Sharma and colleagues at St. George's in London, they have an extensive experience in sports cardiology. They presented an interesting abstract at ESC in which they specifically looked at the adaptations in the female versus male athlete. They had more than 1,000 athletes in their group, 41% women, and they prospectively followed these athletes with echocardiograms. Now, the good news is that 72% of the athletes had no adaptation, no change in LV geometry at all. But that left a substantial portion that did have adaptations in the LV. The big difference came when the research team looked at the endurance athlete, that is, the ones that do dynamic sports like running and cycling. Here, they found that women, much more than men, had eccentric hypertrophy. Men tended to have more concentric hypertrophy. Now, eccentric hypertrophy is when the chamber, LV chamber, dilates, but the wall thickness does not change. Concentric hypertrophy is when both expand, the chamber and the LV walls. And another finding is that female athletes rarely had any increase in relative wall thickness, and they often did not have any significant increases in LV mass. So that's different than male athletes. These are early findings, but they're really important in getting to the distinction between what is cardiac adaptation and what is pathology. Specifically, women may be different than men. Next up, I want to bring up the PCSK9 drugs again. This is a shocking analysis, shocking. Two approved PCSK9 drug inhibitors were found, get this, not to be cost effective at the current pricing. And this report, most recent report, comes from the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review. This is an independent, nonprofit research group. Michael O'Riordan from Heartwire and Medscape has the news story, but the bottom line is that based on a willingness to pay, quote, willingness to pay threshold of $50,000 per quality of life year gained, this group figured that the PCSK9 inhibitors should cost $2,100 per year rather than the more than $14,000 per year currently. So this is confusing to me, right? Because how can we even calculate cost effectiveness at all if we don't know the effectiveness or the benefits? And I highlight this issue because it bears repeating that an elevated cholesterol level is not a disease. An elevated cholesterol level is a risk factor or surrogate for a potential disease. PCSK9 drugs are clearly effective at lowering cholesterol levels. But whether that translates into better outcomes, fewer MIs, fewer strokes, lower mortality, remains to be seen. We simply don't know. Let's say that the PCSK9 drugs don't lower mortality or heart attacks at all. Then the cost effectiveness is none, zero. Next up, I want to talk about the controversial issue of attacks on sugar-sweetened beverages. The Canadian Diabetes Association released a statement recently calling for a national tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. They cite the overwhelming evidence of harm from these excess carbohydrates. They also cite the staggering numbers of Canadians with prediabetes and diabetes. And importantly, they highlight the cost of caring for the diabetic and obesity-related diseases. Although I have concerns about the whole notion and hysteria of disease mongering, that is prediabetes. I'm not sure about prediabetes. I'm not against the idea of a tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. And why not, I say? I mean, I realize that Coke and Gatorade are not the sole causes of obesity, but they sure give obesity and diabetes a tailwind. When I speak with patients in the office about how they lost weight, so a patient comes in, he or she has lost a bunch of weight, I always ask, how did you do it? And a very common answer is they say they gave up or cut down significantly on sugar-sweetened beverages. Speaking of nutrition, in conclusion, I want to direct you to an extraordinary column this week from my partner and colleague, Dr. Melissa Walton Shirley. It's called Imagine Our World If We Taught It How to Eat. And this article is as good as that title. Melissa Walton Shirley attended a session at ESC. It was on healthy eating and how healthy eating can lead to a healthier life. She wrote that it was life-changing being in this session. Now that sounds like hyperbole, but I really don't think it is. Once you start seeing the value, simplistic, beautiful value of good nutrition and the health that comes from good nutrition, I don't think it's hyperbole. I really believe that cardiologists as leaders, as caregivers, as health professionals have to take the lead. I mean, look at the Mediterranean diet, for instance. It's in the New England Journal of Medicine. There's proven benefit and evidence for healthy eating. It makes sense, and it makes sense that we embrace it and we see it as clearly as we see the benefits of drugs or procedures. So that's it for this week in cardiology. This is John Mandrola from theheart.org on Medscape.
You're listening to This Week in Cardiology from theheart.org on Medscape.